side of that. We're called to bring joy to people, to demonstrate God's love, to demonstrate God's healing, because of the cycle we're going to look at this morning. We've been looking at brokenness, at the interaction between sin and brokenness, what brokenness is. This morning, and while I love having uplifting, upbeat Sunday morning services, sometimes or sermons, sometimes you have to look at some tough realities. So we're looking at a tough reality this morning. There's a cycle of brokenness that leads to breaking and being broken. Now, you'll understand, I think, what I mean by that. Let me just give you a hypothetical scenario which plays itself out over and over in the world around us. Abuse is quite common, unfortunately, around us. Parents who are angry with life, frustrated, and take it on their kids. An abused child learns some things about themselves, about the world around them, and about how to interact in relationship. An abused child learns that she's unwanted, worthless, lonely, helpless. And all of that creates a very lonely situation, a lonely child. She learns that conflict is about winning and losing. Whenever there's disagreement, whether there's conflict, whether that's the child wants a candy, or whether that's an adult who sees things one way and someone else sees it a different way, but an abused child learns that conflict is all about winning and losing. Also learns that authority means to be harsh. Because when a child is raised with their authorities who, I'm not talking about firm or discipline, I'm talking about just cruelty and abuse. And they learn that authority has the right to be abusive. So when this child grows up, not always, you understand. In fact, research indicates that over half the children who are raised in abusive situations do not go on to abuse their own kids. This idea that if you've been raised in a hard situation, you have to keep it going is false. But enough do that the cycle is as she grows up and she faces conflict, she's still going to see it as I have to win, right? I have to win if somebody else has to lose. And there's still this friction, this harsh, unhealthy element to conflict, because that's what the child has learned from childhood growing up. If she doesn't change that and unlearn it and learn something else in its place, you know, but someone who is very defensive, very harsh, well, that kind of approach drives people away. You don't want to be around someone that every time anything comes up, they're attacking you over it, right? Nobody wants to be around that person. And so the loneliness that is ingrained in childhood in this abusive situation, because of the lessons this child has learned, makes a very, very lonely adult. And the cycle continues. And so what the lessons learned by sinful behavior reinforce the problems that the person's trying to solve. Does that make sense? One of the great tragedies and dangers of sin is that it presents solutions to a problem that make the problem worse. This dynamic happens whether we're talking your own sin or sin of others. We are affected by sin around us. So Proverbs 29:2 says, when the righteous increase, the people rejoice. When the wicked rule, the people groan. And I understand the context there is primarily running a country, but it works in families too, right? So there's this dynamic of sin that causes harm, causes brokenness. Our attempts to fix that brokenness apart from God make it worse. And so there's a cycle. It's not like just sin happens and then the effect and just that's a little package and then you move on. But it's like dropping a pebble into a pond and the ripples go out and create more ripples. And our response to sin often makes sin worse. When we respond to brokenness in a selfish way, in a sinful way, what we end up doing is making the problem worse. We turn to sin to solve the problems that sin creates. And the cycle continues. That's a cycle of brokenness. We're going to look at a passage of Jeremiah 2. Situation is this. Before you jump, Jeremiah is prophesying, is speaking to the nation of Judah. Now, Israel has been divided in two in history, and they've come in and destroyed the northern nation of Israel, and they're already gone into captivity. About 100 years later, Jeremiah is speaking to God's people who are in Judah, who are still there, but they have gone after idols, they've gone after idol worship, they've turned away from God, and Jeremiah is telling them what is happening to them as a result of that. So we're going to step into it in verse 12. And this is the word of God through Jeremiah. He says, "Be appalled, O heavens, at this. Be shocked. Be utterly desolate, declares the Lord." Now, at this is at what he's just described and continue describing. But I just get the feel here that Jeremiah is describing this cycle of sin and of brokenness that makes sin worse and what happens to us. And God says through Jeremiah, heavens, you know, poetic language here, but the idea is, angels, look how bad this is. Understand the gravity and be horrified at what's going on here, because these people think they're solving their problems as they're making it worse, and it's going up like a snowball going downhill. Be appalled, O heavens, at this. Be shocked, be utterly desolate. The idea is just speechless, in shock, in horror. It's not a light thing. It's not a simple thing. It's not just a little something that we just do and go with and no big deal. To the point that God says, angels, be shocked. And I understand it's poetic language. But the reality is it's a horrible, terrifying process that is so common we lose sight of what's going on. What is the process? It goes on in verse 13. "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed out cisterns for themselves, broken cisterns that can hold no water." So the picture is this. God presents himself as a fountain, as a spring. Now, picture yourself back in that day, largely farming, pretty much subsistence farming. So they're raising crops, they're vineyards, so on. For a farmer to have a living spring, a active spring on his land is incredible, because it's just a source of water that's always there. So God says, I am a fountain of living water. Living water in this case means flowing, moving water. So God says, I am this bubbling spring in your life, a source of health, a source of growth. I provide the needs. God designs every need we have to be fulfilled. Because of sin, they aren't always. There's a reason people preach the prosperity gospel. Hey, as long as you trust God, everything you want will be there. Every need you have will be fulfilled. There's a reason that's a powerful lie. And it's a lie because it denies the reality of sin in our lives, in our world. But the reason it's powerful is because there's a sense that every need we have should be fulfilled. And as God designed the world, they would be. Every need, every drive we have would be fulfilled. And so God presents himself as the fountain of living water, the one who provides all our needs in an ongoing, incredible way. So God says, I'm the fountain of living water, but you've forsaken me. You've turned from me, and instead of using this fountain, this flowing spring on your land, you've dug out a cistern. Now, in that day, there, they would do that. You don't have your own spring. You would literally dig out, well, dig is the wrong word, because a cistern doesn't work in dirt, right? You dig a hole, and the dirt filled with water is going to go away. You have to literally chisel it out of rock, then seal it in order to have a place to collect rainwater. So God says, what you've done is you've ignored me when I'm here offering to meet all your needs, and you've designed something for yourself to meet the need that I'm trying to meet for you. And it doesn't work. You've hewed out cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. Human God intends to meet our needs. Forsaking God means that those needs go unmet. And understand, I'm talking big picture here. I'm not saying that every need you have or desire have is going to be fulfilled in God. We live in a sinful world. There's discipline involved. We get that. But God intends to be the supply for our needs. When we turn away from him, what we're doing is turning away from the ability to have what we need. And our human attempts to fulfill those needs don't work. They're useless. Now let me clarify one thing real quick here as we move on. The dynamic happens, that we're describing here, happens whether you've committed sin or others have committed sin against you. Okay? It starts with sin. This passage is focusing on the sin that people have committed themselves. There's a tendency in our hearts and in our lives to think, I'm suffering, I must have done something wrong. Right? Is that not where we live? Something's wrong in my life. What have I done to deserve this? What have I done wrong? Why has God got it in for me? Right? That's not always the case. Well, God does not have it in for you. Okay, that's never the case. Understand, what I don't want to do this morning is preach this as it's written about someone creating their own problems and have anyone walk away saying, okay, he means all the problems in my life are my fault. Don't go there, okay? So you suffer the same dynamic in many ways, whether someone sins against you and maybe had no control over it, or whether you're sinning against yourself. The focus here is the people have done it to themselves. I just want to be very clear. I'm not saying every problem in your life is your fault. Let's be honest. A lot of them are, right? We do things to ourselves in many cases. So God says, I would meet your needs. Your need, we're talking deep heart needs, need for belonging, need for acceptance, need for significance. I will meet your needs, but you turn away from me and try to do it yourself, and it doesn't work. You've forsaken me, the fountain of living water, and you have hewed out cisterns, broken cisterns, that can hold no water. He says, both of these are evil. My people have committed two sins, forsaking me and trying to solve their problems themselves. All right? Forsaking God is what starts the problem. Then as we try to solve it ourselves, it compounds the problem. And both those are sin. To try to meet needs, to try to deal with ourselves apart from God is sin. One area we have to be very careful of when dealing with the area of brokenness is it does not become an excuse. Secular psychologists will often, at least they're accused, shall we say, and sometimes rightly, of using childhood influences or whatever as excuses that, well, it's okay, they didn't mean it. It's not really their fault, they were just reacting to their environment. Sometimes that is used as an excuse. We don't want to go so far the other way, we ignore the reality that affects us, but not excuse us. Two evils, two sins, forsaking God and trying to handle life on your own. Verse 14. And here we're into descriptions of what has happened and is happening to Israel. Is Israel a slave? Is he a homeborn servant? Two ways you can go into slavery in that day. One was to sell yourself into slavery to pay off debts. If you do that, you can pay off your debts and get out of slavery. But if you're born in slavery, if you're a homeborn servant, if you're born into this area of slavery, you're a slave for life unless your master sets you free. That's just the way the culture was back then. So God is saying, Israel, why are you in slavery? Were you born there? And the answer is no, you weren't born there. I created you free. I created you as my people. So why are you a prey? Why have you become something for other people to take over and to use? Why have you become a prey? God intends us to have freedom. Why are we in bondage? Well, he goes on to answer this. Describing again, historical. The lions have roared against him. They've roared loudly. Again, we're dealing with ancient poetry here. Lions are the picture of an enemy, a violent enemy coming in. And so he's saying, again, talking primarily to the nation of Israel. He says, Israel, your enemies have come in and roared against you. What is that? Why is that significant? Well, let me put it this way. If a lion is stalking someone, is sneaking up on someone, they're not roaring. Right? If a lion is trying to bring down a buffalo, well, I guess buffalo is American. Anyway, a zebra, okay? If that lion roars, the zebra's out of there. So the lion's going to stalk quietly until it pounces. So what he's saying is this, Israel, by forsaking God, you've left yourself so defensive, so defenseless, that your enemies don't even have to sneak up on you. They don't have to fool you. You're just totally wide open and defenseless for anyone to come in and take advantage of you. So he says the lions have roared against him. The lions are so confident that they don't have to sneak up on him. This is just a done deal. They don't have to stalk. You get the picture here? Now the lions, of course, are a picture of Israel's enemies coming in with confidence. We just walk in and they're just ripe for the picking. All right? They've roared loudly. They're making no pretense of trying to fool you, because they don't have to. Because when we forsake God, we leave ourselves so defenseless that sin can just walk in and take over. They've made his land a waste. His cities are in ruins without inhabitant. Again, a picture of Israel's walked away from God, defenseless. His enemies just come in and wipe him out. We are helpless. When we forsake God, we are helpless against whatever destroys us. Now, I know there's self-help programs. I know there's discipline. You can do well outwardly. I get that. But the reality is that down underneath, whatever, when we forsake God, we are helpless against destruction. We are helpless against the enemy's schemes, the sin he brings into our lives. Forsaking God leaves us wide open to all of that. So advertisers will advertise whatever. Alcohol, drugs. Well, they don't advertise drugs. that we know is going to cause bondage. We know can bring us into bondage. But people walk right into it anyway. Because we're helpless against that which destroys us apart from God. Verse 16, moreover, the men of Memphis and Tapanes have shaved the crown of your head. What is that all about? Shaving the head was done to a slave. It's a mark of slavery. Memphis and Tapanes were different capitals of Egypt. Okay? So the men of Egypt have taken you captive and shaved your head as it's, and so your captivity is clear and obvious to everybody. In the end, we're talking the historical time of Egypt attacking Judah. He says the men of the capitals, we would say like the men of Washington, D.C., the country, they've come in and they've taken you captive, they've shaved your head as a demonstration that you're now a slave. It's obvious. We're helpless against that which destroys us. Apart from God, we're helpless against that which enslaves us. Because, well, let's jump to verse 18 for a second. Why are we helpless against that which enslaves us? And now, he says, what do you gain by going to Egypt? Wait a minute. The men of Egypt have enslaved you and shaved your head to demonstrate you're a slave, but you're going to Egypt to get water. See, sin offers to solve problems that it causes. And when we take that route, what we do is end up in deeper problems. And so they're enslaved to Egypt. They've been shamed by Egypt. Egypt's come in and destroyed them. So now they're going to Egypt to get water. And it all started by forsaking God, the fountain of living water, and trying to solve it their own way. And you can see that the snowball effect here. They're trying to solve it themselves. It doesn't work. They're looking elsewhere. Finally, they're going to Egypt. Well, as they're trying to solve it, they're left wide open to anybody who comes along to destroy them. Finally, they end up going to Egypt, the very place that's destroying them. It's the cycle of addiction. And anyone who's worked with addicts understands that you step into something, and whether it's an addiction to alcohol, to pornography, to drugs, to whatever it is, there's a high, you get your fix, and there's a high, then it drops you lower than it was, Then as your life starts unraveling, you start looking around saying, man, this is a mess. I better get my high again because I'm feeling terrible what's going on around me. You do that and it gets worse. And there's a snowball effect. It's most obvious in addiction, but that's the same dynamic in sin every time. We turn for help to that which enslaves us. Take another example. Our culture is obsessed with body image, right? And if you ever do any reading or any checking it out, pictures in magazines and models and so on are not realistic. They are so photoshopped, retouched, they're completely unrealistic, even starting with an unrealistic someone who was through plastic surgery and starvation dieting and whatever. They become unrealistic. It's made even more unrealistic. Then it's put out there. And ladies are more prone to this than guys, but guys are not immune. Put out there, this is what you should look like. And so we have girls who are starving themselves to try to look like this unrealistic picture. If I can just look like that, I'll feel better. I'll have a better image of myself. I'll have a better value. So in seeking for value, they chase themselves after what is horribly unrealistic, can never get there, but if they just push a little bit more, they can get there in their mind and being destroyed because of it. It works with money. And I forget who said this. I don't want to apply the quote, but it was someone of, and now that Trump's president, we think of him as president, when he's a businessman, all right, someone of Trump's caliber of a businessman, incredibly wealthy, was asked, how much money is enough? And this multi-billionaire said, just a little more. Always just a little bit more. That same idea, it's the same dynamic. I can get there, I'm not there yet, but if I push a little harder, I'll get there. And we turn for help to the very thing that enslaves us. Is money wrong? No. But making that the whole goal of our life is wrong. Is looking nice wrong? No. But thinking that my value depends on my looking nice is wrong. And there's this process of turning for help to the very ones who enslave us. What do you gain by going to Egypt to drink the waters of the Nile? Or what do you gain by going to Assyria to drink the water of the Euphrates? So maybe Egypt doesn't work. We're trying something else. We're going to break free of that and try something else, and the dynamic starts over somewhere else. The dynamic of sin and brokenness as we turn for help to the very thing that enslaves us. Can you see a little bit why God says in the beginning here, angels, look at what's going on here. Be shocked at this. Because I'm standing here saying, I'm here to help you, to give you what you need, and they're refusing me and destroying themselves in the process, in this dynamic, this cycle. Verse 17, have you not brought this upon yourself by forsaking the Lord your God when he led you in the way? God says, and again, poetry, some mixed metaphors. It's a spring and he's leading him, okay? The idea is this, God is providing, protecting, taking care of you through life, or he will if we let him. But we turn from him, say, no, I don't want him. He's irrelevant. I don't like what he requires. I want my own thing, right? We turn away from the very source of life itself, who is leading us, who is guiding, who gives us his directions for our own good. It's like you get a motorcycle, and if you know nothing about motorcycles, you get an instruction manual. You throw it away saying, I don't need to read that. All right? Gas, it'll work. Oil, yeah, it works eventually. It seems to be working all right for now. Rain, what was out in the rain last night? Didn't hurt it. It's okay. And ignore all the instructions that come with motorcycle, computer, gun, whatever, right? And think, well, it worked for now. It's okay. So he said, God said, I'm trying to lead you in the way. I'm trying to give you direction and help to make life work like it should. And yet you're refusing that and bringing this cycle of sin and destruction and ongoing brokenness into your life. Verse 18. Your evil will chastise you. Your apostasy will will reprove you. Here's the idea. God doesn't just let us suffer to punish us. God lets us suffer to remind us we have to turn to Him. The results of our own rebellion should drive us to Him. Your apostasy will reprove you. The fact that you've left me, God says, let that sink in, what that's doing to you, and come back to me. Know and see that it is evil and bitter. We're talking about sin and brokenness. Evil has to do with sin, with wrongdoing, with moral wickedness. Bitter has to do with something difficult, something unpleasant. So we have the echo there. It is both sinful because it's ongoing sin in your life, and it's bitter because it causes brokenness, because the effects of sin are horrible. It is both evil and bitter to forsake the Lord your God. The fear of God is not in you. So what do we do? What do we do? Understand what's happening. There's sin. There's brokenness. And how we respond to that brokenness and that sin is key. The fear, why are we in the fear of the Lord right at the end here? It's like out of left field. Where'd that come from? The idea is this. Learn to see your life as God sees your life. Learn the awe and the respect that God deserves. Understand that He's not giving rules just to make you miserable. His laws are not designed to be burdensome. And they're not just a list. Here's a list. Boom, you follow every one of those, and He'll be happy with you. That's not what God's laws are like. His laws are like the instruction manual saying, hey, if I've given you a new life, and I said if you, I almost said if you want a new life. No, you don't get a new life by keeping the rules. It doesn't work that way. But as we're walking with God, His His instructions become principles to guide us, not a stick to beat us if we step over the line. And so David can say, my delight is in the law of the Lord. Why? Because that's the directions for life, not restrictions on life. The fear of the Lord is not in you. So learn the fear of the Lord. Learn to view God not as irrelevant, that I don't need Him, or not as even opposing. One of the greatest lies of sin is this. And I can relate to it because I've been there, where I have a goal, I have a dream, I have something I want to accomplish. If I do what God wants me to, I got to give that up. And I'll always be unhappy. If I go God's way, if I do what God wants me to, I'm always going to be unhappy, less than satisfied, because what I want is this, and I'm just pretty sure God doesn't want me to do that. So, or maybe I know it's wrong, but that's what's feeding me. That's what's getting me through life right now. So if I give that up, I'm going to be left in this no man's land, wandering, trying to find satisfaction following God. God's saying, you don't get it. The fear of the Lord is the idea that God has our best interest in heart, at heart. Well, part of the fear of the Lord is this. Understanding God has our best interest in heart. When He says something, He's saying it for our good. There's a reason for it. We don't ignore Him with impunity. The fear of the Lord needs to be in us. Brings perspective to our lives. What's the response to the cycle of sin and brokenness? Every one of us have been there. And I'll just be on a limb a little bit here. This cycle, this dynamic happens in every one of our lives. We're not to heaven yet. None of us are free from this brokenness and the tendency to respond to it in the wrong way. I'm not standing here before you saying, hey, I have totally solved this whole dynamic in my life. Now you need to join me. That is not the point. All right? There are still times God says, hey, you're messing yourself up here. Hey, your attitude here is poisoning your approach or whatever. It's a dynamic that is ongoing. But as we walk with Him, as we come to Him, turn ourselves to Him, He forgives us and He breaks the cycle of sin and brokenness at the point of sin. He forgives. So we come to Him, we say, I am so sorry. I'm a sinner. I'm wrong. I messed up. I have no excuse. Forgiveness breaks the cycle. Then we're called to work through and correct the cycle. Does that make sense? God, you can't forgive yourself. You can't keep God's laws good enough to be forgiven. But it's also not just an instant thing that suddenly your whole life is put together and everything's in perfect shape. You come to him. You present yourself. I'm sorry. You turn to God through Christ. It breaks the cycle. And as we follow God, we find the replacements for what will actually bring fulfillment. There's a process to it as well. The cycle of sin and brokenness is ongoing. Frankly, it's horrifying. It's a snowball downhill. But God says, come to me. I'll break that cycle. And as you follow me, I'll clean up the mess you've made. I'll turn your life around. Back earlier in the passage, as he leads us in the way, as he walks with us, and we find healing and restoration in him. Amen. Let's stand this morning. If there's any area in your life where you